Здравствуйте. В эфире «Прямая линия» с Владимиром Путиным. В студии
я бы сказала, Мария, что это будет очередной разговор, но сегодня нас слышит другая страна.
А также в эфире телеканалов «Россия-1», «Россия-24».
Очень коротко и очень просто. Спасибо за Крым.
Здравствуйте, Владимир Владимирович. Лариса Медведева.
Здравствуйте, уважаемый Владимир Владимирович.
Вы сказать благодарность вам, Владимир Владимирович, за то, что...
Прошло, но вы победитель.
Спасибо вам большое.
Relaxed, confident, and full of pithy one-liners, Vladimir Putin was in his element this week in his annual call-in show with carefully screened ordinary citizens. The event has been a yearly ritual of his presidency, but this time, coming in the wake of Russia's annexation of Crimea and amid Moscow-backed turmoil in eastern Ukraine, it had more ominous and global overtones as Kremlin watchers tuned in for clues to Putin's intentions. And what we did learn... is pretty disturbing. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hey, Brian.
One thing that was reinforced during Putin's call-in show this week was something I've been thinking about for a while now, and it's this. Putin is taking Russia's virtual politics global, in a sense, with this crisis. He's created a virtual geopolitical reality that everybody knows is fake, but that everybody nevertheless must react to, just as he's long done in domestic politics. It's Surkovism gone global. Maybe without Surkov, but maybe we can talk about that a little bit. Here's what Putin had to say about allegations about Russian troops being present in eastern Ukraine. Let's listen to President Putin.
It's all rubbish. There are no Russian units whatsoever in eastern Ukraine. There are no Russian intelligence services, no Russian political instructors. These are all local citizens.
And here's what he had to say about the so-called fascist menace in western Ukraine.
Nationalism and even neo-Nazism are experiencing a resurgence in western Ukraine. But you know well the history of this territory and its people. Some of these territories were part of Czechoslovakia, some of Hungary, some of Austro-Hungary, and some of Poland, where they were never full-fledged citizens. You know, something has always been growing in their hearts.
Well, that would probably come as a surprise to people here in Prague that Nazism comes from Czechoslovakia. But nevertheless, from Russia's UN ambassador, Dmitry Churkin, saying it was the West's responsibility to prevent a civil war in Ukraine, to Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov saying Moscow's point of view is censored by the Western media, this has been dizzying, even for Russia. I mean, they're dialing it up to 11 here, but in doing so, they've created a reality. And we had to react to it. We had top diplomats from the United States and the European Union in Geneva yesterday reacting to this. Mark, are we witnessing the world's first postmodern war?
Well, I mean, whether we call it a war, I know we're going to come to the whole sort of tactics of asymmetry.
Yeah, no, we will come to this, and that's part of this.
I think what we're really seeing is just an extension. I mean, in Clausewitzian terms, this is Putinism by other means. His tactic has always been to basically create ground truths and then force others to respond to them.
Or virtual truths, as in this case, too.
Well, I mean, what is a sort of a virtual truth? I mean, in a sense, what I mean is he's occupying the info space, put it in those terms. Again, if we, you know, we're thinking of it in these military terms. He's occupying salience, and he's more or less saying, look, these are the truths. And then he challenges, therefore, other people to assail those salients on which he has put his virtual forces. So, I mean, in that respect, I think there's two different dimensions. Firstly, I mean, there are people who will believe what is coming from Moscow. You know, the people who are, for whatever reason, disenchanted with their kind of official, you know, this awful mainstream media term that really causes my skin to crawl. Because this idea, it's somehow suspicious because everyone says it. Well, actually, maybe it's because it's the damn truth. But anyway,
thank you, know, you from somebody who's worked in the mainstream media.
So, I mean, there are some people who will genuinely believe it. And then there's everyone else. And in some ways, what Putin is doing is basically challenging. The same way as in other cases, he sort of challenges and says, well, you know, are you going to try and drive us out by force? Well, likewise, he's saying, look, this is how we are seeing the reality. Are you really going to just turn around and call us liars? And the interesting thing is actually, I mean, the State Department has come closer than it ever has with
two recent sets
of rebuttals, which is fascinating. And it might suggest that in many ways Putin is actually overreaching in doing so. But again, this is the classic thing. He relies on other people's restraint. He relies on the fact that it's not diplomatic language for the, you know, well, if there was an ambassador in Moscow, but, you know, but for basically whoever is handling relations with Moscow to say that Putin's pants are on fire. Instead, they will tend to move more about, well, you know, we do not have any reports of this kind of thing or whatever. Right. Standard diplomatic
And then
speak.
People are left to think there's an actual debate about this.
Precisely. Putin breaks the rules. And that's always been his strength, to know how and when to break the rules. And this is just another sort of facet of that.
The political commentator Peter Pomerantsev had an interesting piece in the FT. It was basically a review of Vladislav Surkov's latest book, which I'm really dying to read. It's about this war of all sides against all sides, which everybody is lying, everybody's making stuff up, and everybody's switching sides right in mid-battle. But the last line of the piece really struck me, where Peter wrote that, you know, actually, Barack Obama was wrong to say that Putin is operating in a 19th century mode. Actually, this is pretty avant-garde, what they're doing here. Sean, what do you think about that?
I was going to mention Peter because he's been the one that's put forward the idea that Putinism is a very postmodern type of governance. And I find this idea really interesting because what Putin is saying, I wouldn't say that this is the first postmodern war. I would point to the first Gulf War as the first postmodern war. But put that aside. What Putin is, what makes it really postmodern, in my view too, is that Putin is about creating narratives. And these narratives, and reality is shaped by the narratives. It's not that reality shapes narratives, it's narratives that shape reality. And a lot of it is based in spectacle. Like the whole idea of these little green men, the friendly people greeting with the local population in Crimea. I think what this does is that, and I think Mark pointed this out in his asymmetrical piece, is that while the rest of the world is figuring out the truth and calling out various false truths that Putin is putting forward, Putin is acting. So I think our approach, if we understand Putin as a postmodern moment, perhaps we should engage in a bit of deconstruction, and rather than trying to say Putin is wrong here, this doesn't really reflect reality, I think we should go forward and try to deconstruct his narratives and deconstruct his text to see exactly what he's meaning and what his intentions are.
Where would you start? That's an interesting thought, and God, I hope you write that up because I'd love to read that. Where would you start there?
One of the things that I've been thinking about is what his meaning of fascism is. This constantly evoked term of neo-Nazism and fascism, it seems to be rooted in a particular type of memory of World War II that he's putting forward. And I think the memory of World War II is really kind of one of the contexts for this conflict. It's being invoked constantly in Russia and by Putin. And what they mean, and they've used fascism as a very slippery term that includes liberals to actually real fascists. And this I think to understand how this plays out in the Russian press and how Putin uses it, I think we need to try to figure out what exactly is his meaning behind these
and
words.
It's all the harder to do when you have articles appearing in Izvestia, Kremlin-approved articles in the most pro-Kremlin newspapers talking about the good Hitler. The one before 38, the one that did Kristallnacht and created the Nuremberg Laws, that Hitler, right? This was in Izvestia, for God's sakes. I mean, and they had to know that this contradicts how this is going to play given the narrative they've been putting out about so-called fascism in Ukraine, but yet they don't seem to care. How do you explain that?
Well, if it's truly a postmodern the postmodern exercise, then there is no grand narrative. It's all a bunch of mini narratives that are being put forward, and their contradictions don't really matter because they're not really connected in a general narrative.
Mark, would you agree? Are there any thoughts on this? Because
I have to confess that, sort of paraphrasing Goering, if I hear postmodernism, I reach for my gun. In some ways,
I'm glad Kirill's not here.
Rather than thinking this is something modern, in some ways I would flip the telescope round and wonder if this is in many ways pre-modern. I mean, I sort of said that in some ways this is much more 19th century and great gamey and so forth, in the sense that there is a lack of meaningful and institutionalized global regimes limiting national activities. I think we can safely say that the UN has not played a sterling role so far, for example, let alone OSCE and something like. A lack of an ideological basis for competition. Instead, it is much more about national interest, but national interest that is often being presented in terms of a civilizing mission. Whether it's saving people or saving civilizations or just simply, sort of bringing the virtues. And in this respect, we're not just talking Crimea. I mean, we're also talking Afghanistan and Iraq or Libya. A conflict that is fought as much as anything else in terms of information spaces and in terms of perceptions is really not that new. Again, in the 19th century, when we talk about the march of empire, often we're actually talking about the march of the presentation of empire, both the domestic populations, but also those people you're planning on conquering. I think we're talking about the same process. We're just choosing to use different historical and conceptual reference. And I am just clearly, essentially antediluvian in this. But I do think that the key thing, and here I think, I'm agreeing with what's being said, is that what it is clear is that this is a conflict in which actually reality is plastic. Reality is there to be defined. And part of that reality is just simply, do you happen to just assert your own lies often enough and forcefully enough? But also part of it is actually how you then try and create realities on the ground.
To match your lies.
Things you can point to and things you can sort of sugar around and say, you see, here is the happy smiling, Donetsk Republican. who is begging Putin to come in and save him and so forth. It's all about creating these narratives.
Go ahead, Sean.
Oh, but what I would add, what makes this kind of different, I agree with most Mark put forward, but I would have to say that the one key element in all of this is that all of these narratives are meant to appeal to the public. Right. This isn't really about states talking to states or diplomats talking to diplomats. It's about trying to cultivate a narrative for the public to understand and the public to follow. I think the audience is one of the things that makes it somewhat postmodern.
But it's an international audience as well as a domestic.
Very
audience.
Much so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But again, they do connect because, in some ways, I suspect that part of the Russian gambit is precisely to create and to demonstrate that there is such a groundswell within Russia that actually Putin's hands are tied. There is no way now, even it doesn't matter what the West offered him, there is no way that Putin could hand back Crimea, for example. And I think part of that is exactly, it's creating a situation where he's just saying, look, realistically, I can't do this because of all my people and what they feel. Mm-hmm, so, I think there is a feedback loop between the geopolitics, the national politics, and the international information space.
Well, in terms of the plasticity of reality, as I think both of you put it, this, as I said at the outset, is what they've been doing in domestic politics from the beginning of the Putin presidency. This is Vladislav Surkov's world. Right. But what's interesting is where is Surkov? And I'm not going to get through this segment without mentioning him. Where is Surkov? Because it's very interesting. He was in Ukraine before this all started, but the chatter in the Russian media was that he failed and that he was sidelined for all of this. But yet they are using these Surkovian methods. Is this international Surkovism without Surkov? I mean, it's I don't know what my question is here, but what do you think about that? It's any thoughts on that at all?
I actually think this – I don't know where Surkov – what no, he's up not, to not, right not, now either, but I think this is – kind of normal practice of kind of international politics today, kind of creating narratives and creating a spectacle and scene. Like I said, in terms of the first postmodern war, I mean, if you recall the first Gulf War, it was completely this staged spectacle of the bombings on television, the Patriot missiles. The war was even dubbed the video game war. So I think my point being is that with modern technology, especially now with it so rapid with social media, this is the normal to create narratives and not to have a grand narrative, to have it break down and splinter and fragment. So you appeal to whatever population based on whatever conditions is kind of the normal practice now.
This may not be the first one, but it's never been dialed up to 11 like this.
I certainly agree that the Russians are kind of over. There's a problem with kind of being too postmodern, where it really your narratives completely outstrip reality. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, here and there, and they're in a position where they've put forward a narrative that's so kind of out of scope that they have to try to bring reality up to the narrative, right. And that's the most difficult part.
But they're doing it. They're doing it very effectively right now.
But they've always done this. I mean, I think there's a danger. I mean, I appreciate that for you, the world is like, it's like that kind of, where's Wally? Where's Surkov?
I don't think it's about Surkov now. It's about Surkovism, because I think Surkov's sidelined right now.
What Surkov did in many ways was actually take a classic Soviet tactic, but adapt it and give it a great extra sort of sheen and glitz and so forth. You know, you think of whether it's, for example, I remember when Soviet forces rolled into Afghanistan, the only mention was just a single little thing saying in Pravda, saying that Soviet-Afghan relations have opened a new chapter. you know, if we think about the Soviets throughout, they sought to redefine reality. They sort of, you know, they have friendship universities for training spies. You know, they, for heaven's sake, they had their newspapers, Pravda and Izvestia. You know, and we all know about the old jokes about that and Trud. But in some ways, I think that actually what Surkov did was in many ways was to rediscover something that in their own ways the Soviets had actually learned very, very well, as do almost all. I hesitate to say the Soviet regime wasn't totalitarian, but it was nudging that way. It was more than just authoritarian. Because, I mean, authoritarian regimes care about what you do. Totalitarian regimes care much more about also what you think. And the Soviets were sort of wandering that way. I mean, but so in that respect, I mean, I think we have to accept that actually why this is so significant is that, as it were, through the shade of Surkov, actually, Putin is in many ways tapping into something that the Soviets did a long time.
And what he's tapping into is socialist realism. This is what I think the kind of aesthetic model that's being transferred into a new situation is this idea that you have imagery and art and the aesthetics essentially representing the future. You don't represent the present. You represent what you want it to be. And a lot of the images and narratives that are being put forward by Putin is what he wants or what he wants you to think it is rather than the reality. And this goes all the way back to the socialist realist aesthetic established in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think he's doing it for now very, very effectively. Another thing that jumped out at me, and Mark, you anticipated me a little bit on this, and you had an excellent piece on this not long ago, is that Putin seems to have mastered the art of asymmetrical warfare. For him, Ukraine is an existential issue. For the West, it's peripheral. Russia's ready to use force. The West isn't. Putin knows this and is taking full advantage of it. And during his call-in show, he wasn't shy at all about reminding the world of this fact. We got a couple of clips here we want to play. Let's listen.
Russia did not annex Crimea by force. With the help of armed formations and, I'll be honest, armed forces, Russia only created conditions for a free expression of the will of the people living in Crimea and Sevastopol. It was them who made a decision to join Russia. Let me remind you that the Federation Council of Russia gave the president the right to use the armed forces in Ukraine. I very much hope that I will not have to exercise this right, and that through political and diplomatic means, we will be able to resolve all the pressing, if not to say burning, issues in Ukraine.
So in one case, Putin is saying, wink, wink, we didn't use any force in Crimea, wink, wink. We just created the conditions so people can express their wills. In the second, he reminded the world that, I might use force. The Federation Council's given me this authority, and I hope I don't have to use it, but I may. But this is asymmetrical because we know the West isn't going to use force in Ukraine. He knows he's not going to be confronted with this, and that's an advantage, and he's exploited that. Mark, you recently had a very good piece in this. How long can this last, and when does it hit the point of diminishing returns?
Well, I think it'll last a long time. I mean, I think this is in many ways Putin anticipating the way that conflicts are going to be fought in the future. Because it's interesting, you talk about asymmetrics. Russia is militarily vastly weaker than the West. And Putin knows that full well. I mean, fine, so he now has some special forces with nifty goggles and knee pads who look very nice. But, in reality, the majority of Russian armed forces are still way, way behind the West, and even the best does that.
Before we go around that, I wanted to ask you to clarify something, because there was a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks back saying that looking at the Russian troops on the Ukrainian border, what was striking to the authors of the article was that how much more well-equipped and advanced they were compared to the troops in Georgia. Do you have been serious advances been made since 2008?
Serious advances have been made, but the key thing is the forces that rolled into Georgia were on the whole just your regular motor rifle troops. The forces whom we see deployed in Crimea and elsewhere around the Ukraine are basically special forces and fairly special forces. Okay. They're naval infantry, they're airborne, they're spetsnaz.
So we're looking at different troops here. Okay, good.
Now, in many ways, Russia has two armies. Russia has a small, essentially professional, relatively well-trained and relatively well-equipped force, and then a much larger, still largely conscript and frankly not very good army.
Right. Okay.
But going back to this, in some ways, that's fine for the kind of asymmetric conflict that Putin is envisaging, because actually what he needs is not serried ranks upon ranks. He needs a relatively small number of elite forces who can often operate in small groups, perhaps undercover, etc., as part of these kind of blended operations. And again, I think this is very much the way that war is going to be fought in the future, because regular war is ridiculously expensive in all kinds of different ways. It'll be fought by a mix of special forces, of local insurgents, of all kind of other means, non-military means, including diplomacy, including outright lying, including dealing with organized crime, including espionage. And this has been something that the Soviets were always quite good at, and I think, again, the Russians have inherited that. But I think also it's something that we clearly have seen the Russians have developed, of how can we have an instrument which allows us to, in effect, invade neighboring countries
without
invading them in such a way that it triggers or risks triggering some kind of a response. So it's, it's a modernized version of the salami slice tactics that they used after World War II.
When does this hit a point of diminishing returns, though? When does it really begin to provoke a response? When does it become costly? When do the costs become unacceptable?
When they make a mistake is the honest answer. When, let's say, they overreach, they think something is going to have only a small impact, and in fact it hits someone's red line or whatever, or when just something happens, stuff happens, that you think you have it carefully calibrated. But, for example, we know that although there is considerable sort of political control, a lot of the militants, really we should call them paramilitaries, in eastern Ukraine are locals, probably payrolled or coordinated by local political elites. What happens if one of them does something stupid and, I don't know, shoots a Western journalist in front of a camera crew? Things that can't be predicted in these messy situations. Mm-hmm. And that might trigger something more. So it's essentially an exercise in brinkmanship and bluff, as well as direct kinetic action.
But what if they keep, assuming something, they don't do something stupid, something doesn't go wrong? Is there a point where this is going to, and I'm thinking this week, we all saw Rasmussen's statement that NATO is going to reinforce its forces by land, sea, and air and on its eastern frontier. We're beginning to see kind of NATO rebuilding up along the east. When does it get to the point where they can no longer operate freely? How many, is it in Ukraine? Is it in Moldova? Is it, you know, when does this stop? Or is this?
Well, I mean, I think we have to realize the limits of Putin's ambition. I mean, he is not some kind of Zhirinovsky figure who, if I can kind of flip Zhirinovsky's phrase around geographically, will not be content until Russian soldiers wash their boots in the English Channel. I think the limits of Putin's imperialism very much are around the limits of the Soviet Union, but above all of the ethnic Russian population of the Soviet Union. So from that point of view, you know, NATO can spend as much money as it wants, not a problem, as long as it's, you know, Putin manages to avoid being in a position in which there's confrontation with NATO. I mean, I don't think the Baltic states, for example, are in question. I don't think there's any thought about Finland or Sweden or whatever. Moldova, maybe. But again, would NATO go to war for Moldova? That's questionable.
Yeah. No, I mean, one thing I kept coming back to is, like, and Mark, you'll correct me if I'm wrong here. I'm sure you will. During the Cold War, the Soviets cleaned the West's clock in the espionage game, basically. I mean, is what it is always been my assumption. But it didn't matter. They mastered that game. They were better. Maybe I'm wrong. What am I wrong? Before I.
Well, I mean, it's difficult to kind of reach a sort of a single. You know, I mean.
Maybe clean your clock is too strong.
A lot of massive and effective Western successes. I mean, I think really this speaks to intelligence generally. On the whole, intelligence tends to make no difference at all in the big scheme of things. But I mean, there were some specific areas. I mean, for example, if one looks at the development of the Soviet nuclear weapon, I mean, that was one area in which actually espionage led to a very real geopolitical impact or whatever. But those incidents are few and far between, it has to be said.
Sean, any thoughts?
I think the only thought I have is that you might get diminishing returns in this once Putin doesn't have plausible deniability, which would be if indeed he moves troops formally into Ukraine. I think this might trigger some backlash or some greater response from the West. But on the whole, I agree with Mark. I think the one thing he does have to worry about is something going wrong on the ground that is out of their control.
Right. Before we move on to the next segment, what did both of you make of yesterday's Geneva agreement? I saw Russia make a lot. I mean, concede a lot here, and I was kind of curious why. What did you guys think, Mark? Go ahead.
I mean, okay, to leap in first. I mean, my view is, I mean, first of all, that actually conceding terms when they actually relate to forces over whom you claim you have no authority.
That was interesting.
Is relatively easy. I mean, it's a little bit like me selling the Brooklyn Bridge. That's fine, except that I have no right to be able to assign value to the Brooklyn Bridge. So, I mean, I think that this was one of the things that, again, if we're talking about creating narratives, it allows the Russians to say that they are being constructive and positive. But then all they have to do is just simply rely on their agents on the ground to be intransigent. And then they can just simply say, well, what can you do? But I think the second point is this is only part of the negotiation process. It also very, very much depends on what Kiev offers. I don't believe for a minute that actually, you know, Putin wants to annex huge swaths of Ukraine. But I think he has a very clear sense of what he wants from Kiev, which includes essentially accepting its position within the Russian sphere of influence with everything that entails and granting great sort of degrees of autonomy to the east. That's, I think, his plan A. I mean, he's willing to accept an annexation if need be, but that's definitely plan B. So, I mean, in that context, this is a piece of paper which at present has very little real weight. Moscow could give it weight, could start to rein in its agents, but I think it'll be waiting for Kiev to make it worth its while.
Sean, any thoughts?
I found the statement an interesting text in the sense of it here, and here goes back to our kind of postmodern discussion where it could be interpreted by all parties in a different way. So, for example, from Moscow's point of view, I wonder who exactly they think the armed insurgents, armed groups that need to be demilitarized are. Are they right sector? Or do they mean that groups that are on the Kiev side? So the people who are occupying buildings, do they mean the Kievan government? Do they mean the people in the Maidan? I mean, it's open to a lot of interpretation depending on your perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. And what I'm looking at the statements out of the foreign ministry today, and they were focusing on it's time for Kiev to start negotiating with legitimate authorities in the east. That's what they're choosing to focus on.
Right.
The Western side, of course, is focusing on you have to get out of those buildings in Donetsk and Slavyansk and these other eastern cities. So, well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and our interpretation of President Putin's comments at his call-in show and see what we've gleaned. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
В исторической памяти под коркой, где-то там в душе, хорошо, знаете, историческое прошлое этой территории, этой земли и этих людей. Сейчас об этом говорила, о Новороссии, которая, безусловно, корнями связана
его формирования на ближайшую историческую и более отдаленную историческую перспективу.
Это тоже есть какая-то здесь вот...
Путин talked a lot about history during his call-in program, especially Ukrainian history. And this again made it clear that Putin is deadly serious about rewriting history and redressing what he sees as past historical injustices. Let's listen to a couple of cuts of Putin talking about Ukraine and Ukrainian history and its relationship to Russia. Let's listen.
Вопрос в том, чтобы обеспечить законные права и интересы русских и русскоязычных.
The essential issue is how to ensure the legitimate rights and interests of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in the southeast of Ukraine. I would like to remind you that what was called New Russia back in the Tsarist days, Kharkov, Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, Nikolaev, and Odessa, were not part of Ukraine back then. These territories were given to Ukraine in the 1920s by the Soviet government. Why? Who knows? They were won by Potemkin and Catherine the Great in a series of well-known wars. The center of that territory was Novorossiysk, so the region is called Novorossiya. Russia lost these territories for various reasons, but the people remained. Central, eastern, and southeastern Ukraine is another matter. I've just mentioned this area, New Russia, which has intertwined its roots with those of the Russian state. The local people have a somewhat different mentality. They found themselves part of present-day Ukraine, which had been pieced together in the Soviet period. Of course, it is difficult for them to establish proper relations and to understand each other. But we should help them to do so as much as we can.
Novorossiya has become, it's become a phrase that you only used to see in nationalist texts. Suddenly you have the president of the Russian Federation talking about it to the entire nation on his live call-in show. And with the facts on the ground tell us this is no longer an academic exercise. Sean, you're the historian. Your comment?
This reflects, again, what we've been seeing from Putin lately, this reversion to this incredibly primordial understanding of Russia and the Russian lands, and Russia being essentially where Russian-speaking people are. So you get this essentially this equation that where Russians live is where Russian land is, and it goes back to this far history of the Tsarist period. Essentially, Putin's conception of Russia seemed to be the Tsarist Russian Empire, and I find this nationalist talk incredibly disturbing.
No, it is. Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would want to throw in one caution about thinking of this as just like a resurgence of the Tsarist Empire, because we do have to recognize still that actually we have not had, you might say, the sort of official laws and such like at the moment coming from the center, which are very much backing ethnic nationalism. His notion of where Russia's borders lie essentially are exactly where Russians are, Russian speakers, and or perhaps more generally Russian culture. But on the other hand, we haven't seen a sense that non-Russians should be being treated as second-class citizens and subject people.
Not officially.
Well, actually, I mean, you know, we've spoken about this in past podcasts, that in many ways it's the Navalny's of this world who are actually more the ethnic Russian nationalists than the Putins. So, I mean, I think there is distinction here. I mean, I definitely believe that he is an imperialist who sees himself really as, you know, as presenting an empire based upon, as it were, Russian civilization, let's call it, which is clearly based on Russian orthodoxy, Russian culture, and everything else. So yes, it is an empire of sorts, and yes, it is indeed alarming. And I think it's new. This is not what we saw in the first Putin terms. The first Putin terms, he was really quite strikingly pragmatic. Yes, he would mobilize the language of nationalism when it was useful. He would ignore it when it was not. Now, though, I think we really do find that Putin actually seems to be believing what he's saying, and actually feels in some ways he has no option. I mean, there was a fascinating quote from Yakunin, who, you know, head of Russian railways, also very close to Putin, but also arguably the lead figure of the so-called Orthodox Chekists, the kind of KGB Russian Orthodox Church alliance we've seen, who was saying that basically, you know, what was going on in Crimea was such that, you know, the Russian people and Russia itself demanded action. And I think this is interesting because it's implying that there is that sense of a greater mission, of which Putin is just simply the obvious, you know, the executor, rather than it just simply being whatever Putin happens to dream up tomorrow.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I would have to say that, you know, along with this, you do see a greater shift in his language, where he talks more about Ruski rather than Rossiski.
Yeah.
The idea of Russia as a multi-ethnic federation is kind of left to the side, and his conception of Russia seems to be shifting to this only Russia is Ruski rather than Rossiski. And while, yeah, I don't perceive that there's going to be laws that make non-Russians second-class citizens within the Russian Federation, it's an interesting shift because we didn't see this in his earlier terms. He mostly spoke about a kind of Rossiski citizenship, and now we have this great shift to ethnicity.
One has to wonder if the ethnic nationalism isn't being just used as a tool to advance the state nationalism or the imperial policy, no? Not less of a shift and more that you're using one to buttress the other.
I mean, it's certainly possible, but, you know, he could also claim Crimea for kind of more non-ethnic terms, for kind of expansion of territory, taking in more subjects, making the state stronger. But he's putting it more in, and he uses these terms constantly, Russians and Russian-speaking people. He's not thinking of the Tartars, for example, in Crimea when he incorporates Crimea.
No, he certainly isn't. But they had a lot to say about that. We had a podcast on that a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. Mark, what do you think? Is this worth seeing?
Actually, I would agree with you, Brian, in the sense of I think this is more, rather than thinking that the language, the shift in language, which, you know, absolutely has been the case, necessarily says that there's been some dramatic change in his conception. I think it reflects the nature of the time. I mean, at the moment, the key salient issue is precisely Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and the key rationale for that is precisely that there are quote-unquote Russians at threat. And therefore, obviously, he's going to be talking about Russians, he's going to be talking about Russian Brotherhood and so forth. But the interesting thing is that sort of, I think even that, I mean, that while it's clear that, yes, the Crimea was not saved for the Tatars, you know, but nonetheless, there is a level of discomfort within the government, you know, about, well, how can we bring a Tatar dimension into this? They're not just simply saying, and as for the Tatars, out of hell with them.
No, they're trying, you know, to make it
precisely
seem like it.
I mean, you know, I think it's more than just lip service to the notion that this is a multi-ethnic empire. It is an empire. And in this respect, it's actually quite familiar to the sort of debates and discussions that we've had in the UK, in which there is that attempt to try and say that there is something special and wonderful about Englishness, but that need not be at the cost of all the other ethnicities and cultures present. So, I mean, I think it's a delicate balancing act, but I think Putin is still trying to balance.
Yeah. No, one other thing that I think I agree with Sean on this, and I think there's domestic purposes to usurping this nationalist, ethnic nationalist language. And I mean, think about it. A year ago on this podcast, we were commenting about all we were talking about was Navalny. And we were only mentioning Putin in passing as he related to Navalny. Well, this is the first time I think I've said Navalny in this entire podcast. And we've been talking about Putin the entire time, and we have been. So in a sense, Putin has stolen Navalny's thunder on this. I mean, I think there maybe was a domestic political calculation involved here. But again, just like I think the ethnic nationalism is being used to buttress the imperialism, it's also being used for domestic purposes rather than a shift in orientation. Any last thoughts before we move on to the last thing?
Yeah, I would say that this shift to kind of a more ethno speech on the part of Putin is completely consistent with his general return to the presidency and his shift to Russian conservatism in general. I do think you're right in a sense he's trying to capture the kind of more Russian nationalist views on the street, but he's also tapping into a widespread feeling amongst Russians in general that are very conservative and traditional values, the Orthodox Church.
Yeah, it's funny how all of these themes that we've been hitting on, remember we did the Putin trying to become the leader of the world's conservatives, all these things are kind of crystallizing and coming together in this in this crisis. Last thing I wanted to talk about, last thing that jumped out at me during Putin's call-in show this week, was that Putin has very successfully changed the conversation in Russia. Completely. I mean, the conversation in Russia's done a 180. We don't hear about the party of swindlers and thieves anymore. We haven't been reading snarky blog posts about Putin's Botox habit. Ukraine's been a game changer this way. And for now, at least, Putin appears to be the master of the game. How sustainable is this?
I would say that it has a sort of a limited sustainability. I mean, the same way as Sochi. At the time, Sochi completely sort of, you know, was this great symbol of not just we can do it and we are a nation of champions, but also those unpleasant Westerners who are just simply carping about the toilets and such like, and it says something about the Westerners. Now, Sochi is long gone, and now it's just simply a question of, well, you know, how are they going to use these buildings? You know, obviously Crimea is different. I mean, I think it's a whole order of magnitude different. And yes, it has created a situation in which almost nobody I haven't really come across a Russian who has serious concerns or problems with what's happened. If they have concerns, they tend to be practical ones about, oh, well, what will happen in terms of will we be able to travel? No one actually is sitting there thinking, gosh, this is essentially immoral for our regime or anything like that. You know, this is something that really can unite 99.whatever percent. And what's more, it's fascinating because it also demonstrates, and this is not just a sort of, you know, the wider issue about how Navalny has been sidelined, but that actually the state is also in some ways using some of the techniques of the opposition. You go to Taganskaya metro station, for example, and there's a massive piece of street art of Crimea, but painted in Russian flags, sort of colours. So, I mean, you know, even things like street art that we would think of as, you know, impromptu street art, we would think of as tools of the opposition are now becoming tools of the regime. But the point is, yeah, all these things only last for so long, especially if that's going to be offset against, you know, economic issues in the future, especially if there are more sanctions and sanctions that really begin to bite more generally rather than a handful of oligarch types. And then, in a way, the danger for me is the inexorable logic, which is then, well, we need another hit. We need something else.
You just anticipated me, because I want to read a quote. This one's not from Putin. It's from Walter Russell Mead. He wrote this in an article in the American Interest this week, and it just really jumped out at me. Quote, victories like those Putin has notched up in Ukraine will awaken rather than slake his ambition. He needs triumphs abroad to vindicate and justify his rule and his repression at home, and foreign policy victories are like cocaine when it comes to their impact on public opinion. The buzz of each hit wears off, leaving only the craving for another and larger dose. Putin has grown and will grow hungrier and more reckless with each victory achieved. That pretty much sums it up. I mean, is this like cocaine? Does he have to keep going in order to? I mean, because he's gotten big domestic benefits out of this, but they're going to be short lived. I mean, I think Walter Russell made it on the head here. It is kind of like cocaine, and then they need another hit. But this is again back to what I've been coming through throughout this. Is this sustainable, and when does this stop, Sean? You.
Yeah, I mean, it is brief. I mean, you can only keep the population mobilized around patriotism for so long before it dies down. It dies down because events die down, or it dies down because people get tired of hearing it and seeing it, and they become apathetic to whatever, the international crisis that's causing this patriotism. But the only thing that can sustain is if there is a repeat of the crisis, right? If the crisis is driven up more, then the patriotism will be driven up more so they can sustain it. So in a sense, I kind of agree with this quote. And I agree with it too, because as we've said repeatedly on this podcast, they don't really have any other strategy for the country right now.
Right.
There's no – like since Putin has come back to the presidency, he hasn't put forward really a kind of strategy to lead the country to the future. And he's only been, on the one hand, he played to this conservative base that sustained things for a bit. Now he has the crisis in Crimea. He had Sochi Olympics, and that's did some sustaining. And now he has the crisis in Ukraine. That's in annexation of Crimea. That's going to keep him afloat. But what's going to happen after that?
Economic problems on
the horizon. What is he going to offer the population for the future?
Well, you have to wonder, let's do the math. I mean, this thing's been going on for 5 months now, and basically right. Since the Vilnius summit back in November. It's probably got a couple more months left in it. And then there's Moldova, there's northern Kazakhstan. I mean, you can drag these things out for a couple of years, I think, or no. Mark, does Putin have enough cocaine to keep the population high that long?
Well, I mean, I think I'd be a little bit less deterministic and assume it has to be that way. I mean, two things. One is that... I mean, actually, you know, Putin has considerable strengths. We are presuming, for example, that the economic crisis will bite, which I think is, in due course, which I think is a fairly safe bet. But on the other hand, we don't know if, for example, Navalny or the opposition will manage to recover, or whether or not some new force will arise. I mean, it might be that, in fact, he can just coast along, even with economic crisis. If there is no real challenge...
Right.
Then you can last quite a while. But also, I mean, I think, and this is slightly devil's advocating, I mean, potentially this gives him a window of opportunity, because this is a massive re-legitimating moment. It's only short-lived. He can't then sort of base the whole rest of his next presidential election on the "I took Crimea years ago," even though he did try and last a long time on "I'm not Yeltsin." but I mean, there is the scope for him to use this to rebuild some kind of relationship with the country, and especially because, I mean, the whole sanctions issue has given new life to the notion of deoffshoreization, and therefore bringing the elite much more closely within the state's control, and making sure that the elite are patriots too. He could use this precisely to turn around and actually say, well, we are clearly assailed by the outside world. We Russians must stick together. And part of that is making sure that ordinary Russians see that even the rich Russians are doing their bit. When they just came out recently with their income filings, the official income things, and it was noticeable. I mean, okay, these things are largely works of fiction, but it was noticeable that sort of Putin was in the lower half. And I think that could be used precisely to mobilize that sense of, look, you know, yes, this is time to actually bring the boyars to heel. And with the popular legitimacy that Crimea and maybe Ukraine provides him, and that, you know, there is the chance that he could use that to rebuild his relationship with the Russian people. I have no idea if he will, but I think we have to accept that there are multiple potential scenarios.
Yeah, but he's going to be doing it with the Russian people who are now cut off from the globalized economy, or more cut off than they were from the globalized economy. And that could be problematic, no?
Well, he could.
Well, we'll see how much they cut.
Right.
He could use the opportunity of Russia's being isolated from the rest of the world as a means to kind of build up its own national base and say, well, we're cut off. We need to fend for ourselves. Therefore, we need to have, you know, patriotism for our consumerism. We need patriotism for our national economy, et cetera, et cetera. And he could use this as a means to kind of revitalize the internal dynamics of the Russian economy.
Yeah, you have to wonder though if that's going to fly with people who are like in their 20s and 30s now, who have like, you know, grown accustomed and think it's their birthright to basically, you know, travel in Europe when they want and
right, but they're not Putin. but they're not Putin's audience anyway, right. So...
No, but they're the growing part of the population and not the shrinking part. Bear in mind,
this is something that the West is doing to Russia. I mean, given that this constituency is also still supportive of policy over Crimea and so forth, so on the one hand, Putin is doing what they think is right, and in return for that those spiteful, nasty Westerners are doing all these things that are wrecking our economy. Mm-hmm.
So this could be a sea change. I mean, do either of you see us going back to the pre-Crimea status quo in any way? I'm increasingly thinking no.
It's going to be something new. I mean, definitely, I think Putin's imperialism, Putin's notion of himself as having this messianic role, I think is new and is not going to go away. And the implications of Crimea, whether it's undermining ultimately of Putin or whether it's allowing him to build some new kind of relationship, but again, one way or the other, they're not going to disappear.
All right, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for an enlightening discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.